Good evening, everybody. I'm Linus Tapley, and it's my pleasure to be chairing this first of the keynote papers this evening, what we might call the late show. But as you'll know from your programme, the presentation is by Vanek Volkan, who I will introduce in a moment, and the discussant is Ross Lazar, who I will introduce later. But just to let you know how we're going to go about the process so that you know where we're going, Vanek is going to speak for about 45 minutes or so, followed by Ross for about another 10 minutes, and we hope that then that'll give us something like about 15 minutes for your questions and discussion at the end. And we might just even nick into the little space that is provided between this event and the one following, if indeed we have a lot of questions and answers to deal with. So can I first introduce to you Vanek Volkan. He will be well known by reputation to many of you for his many publications. And just a little bit about his background. Vanek is the president of the American College of Psychoanalysts. He is a doctor of medical science, honoris causa at Kuopio, University in Finland and at Ankara University in Turkey. He is professor emeritus of psychiatry at the University of Virginia, senior Erik Erikson scholar at the Erikson Institute of Education and Research at the Austin Riggs Center, and training and supervising analyst emeritus at Washington Psychoanalytic Institute, Washington. The title of Vanek's paper is Ancient Fuel for a Modern Inferno, The Reactivation of a Chosen Trauma, and I invite Vanek to come and present his paper. Thank you.
Introduction, and thank you for the organization for inviting me. Now, I want to tell you something. First, confession. I don't know much about organizations. So this morning, I was sitting with Leopold Mancina. Where is he? Somewhere. Oh, there he is. And we ended up talking about what he has been doing and what I have been doing. I've been doing international relations in quotation marks. Thank you. And he has been doing organizational whatever. And we found out that we have many things in common. So I suspect that what I will tell you can be transferred. He will approve or not approve. So at the end of this meeting, we'll ask him.
I've been listening.
You have been listening. Okay. So, accident, I've been involved in world affairs about 30-35 years, and I cannot tell you the story because it's too long and too funny. So, but when I bring enemy representatives together for unofficial dialogues, they right away something comes up, and I named it large group identity. And my last book, in fact, is Killing in the Name of Identity. When large group identity becomes prominent, people become under its psychology, and they will do anything, masochistic or sadistic, to protect and maintain their large group identity. And it's very difficult to describe it. It can be ethnic, it can be Taliban brothers, it can be Apaches, it can be communism, it can be we are Polish. And that is a lecture by itself, how to describe large group identity, but you describe it for yourself. Okay? And as time went on, you know, it is very difficult to shake off things that we learn so many years that we practice. And in 2006, I had the honor of being the Freud, whatever, professor during the year of Freud in Vienna. And I had an office at 19 Berggasse. And the lady who ran the place, I was expecting to do all kinds of things, like bring the diplomats and psychoanalysts together, which we did, but it wasn't so big. And I had nothing to do in Freud's house. So I kept thinking about Freud and how he told us not to touch international relations. And I figured out how depressed he was and how much survival guilt he had. But as I was doing this, I suddenly felt free to not to follow him in certain areas. You see, large group psychology in psychoanalysis primarily is what a large group means for the individual. And that's true, I think, for many schools of psychoanalysis. So when you get into the field, you figure out that we need a new psychology, a large group psychology in its own right, how large groups relate to each other. Large groups, millions of people, or at least 10,000 of people, they don't have one brain. They don't have two eyes to cry or one brain to think. So when an individual process takes its course, because large groups are made of people and therefore individual psychology is its basis. But when a defense mechanism or a psychological process is shared by a million people, it's going to appear in a societal process, cultural process, or political process. And when large groups get together, so to speak, or when they fight, we need to find out what is this large group psychology. Just let me give you just a very brief example. We all know what is projection or externalization. It is not I who stink. It is my friend, new friend, Perino. Perino stinks, so that's a projection. We know that. But supposedly, 1 million people do it. Okay, now he's my friend, more friend than ever, because he's not part of me, isn't him? Okay. Then you see a societal process. Societies turn to be like snakes. They shut off things that are unwanted, and that can be not dangerous. Best example that I know, I'll count the examples, like you go to Greece today, and people speak Greek, and you never think that if you went to Greece in 1820, that language did not exist there. They were living under Ottomans, my ancestors occupied them for 400 years. America is only 200 years. Can you imagine 400 years they lived under the Ottomans? So they were speaking, they were Turkophones. So when they gained their independence, they projected, they externalized Turkish words, except real mother thing they could not externalize. So the Turkish food names and Greek food names are food eating, mother, still the same. But other things, they externalize. When Latvia gained its independence, Latvia, they wanted to get rid of Russian bodies in their national cemetery. You see, you externalize. Okay? Same thing with regression. You know what regression is. If you are regressed, when you go home tonight, you're going to check under the bed to see if there is a monster, or you're going to look for a woman with big breasts like Niagara Falls milk coming. Okay. So you know what regression is. All psychologists are lay people. What about if a large group regress? Millions of people regress. Then you're going to see it as a societal process or political process. And in one of the books, I describe 20 signs of it, but I will stay tonight with one of them. Large groups also go back in history. When you regress, you go back in your individual history. When large groups regress, they go back in their shared history. And they go back to what I call chosen traumas. That is a disastrous historical event which changed function and became a number one important marker for that large group. only that large group, only that ethnic group, only that tribe, only that ideological group has that history. Nobody else has it. Therefore, it becomes a marker. Okay? So when I got the invitation and I looked at the
brochure
and ghost and so on, I said, okay, I will come here and tell you about a ghost. A ghost meaning a chosen trauma that comes back, gets reactivated. So it's the chosen trauma, a ghost from the past, and maybe at the end we can talk about when, after it gets reactivated, how we can make an angel and use it for good things. Okay? So that is my speech tonight. Okay? And so I chose one chosen trauma of Serbian people. And when I look at the list, there was only one Serbian person from Serbia here. This is Marina, my good friend Marina, who has known me for some time. When I talk about Serbia, this doesn't mean that Serbians are different than anybody else. I have been to almost every conflicted area in the last 35 years. I just tell you something. We are all the same human beings. And if you want to find out how we are same, go to South Africa, to Kruger Park, and watch lions and the elephants and so on, how they behave. We behave the same way, but since we have bigger brains, we make a mess out of it. So talking about Serbia doesn't mean that I love Marina, so she allows me to talk about Milosevic, basically. Okay. So let me see now what I'm going to do. This is now, I can point anywhere, right? All right, I'm going to point anywhere. Okay, this is my title. You got it? And how a chosen trauma occurs. So we'll just say that, and then we discuss a chosen trauma. Every large group has chosen trauma. I have a list of them, some other PowerPoint. So after a massive trauma at the hand of others, I'm not talking about massive trauma from earthquakes, and now the oil spill is the biggest disaster for America and the world. It is different. It is done by a small group of people, BP, and be angry at them. Or Chernobyl, we can be angry at, but it's not deliberate. I'm talking about deliberately. Another group with another identity comes and kills you in the name of identity. I'm talking about that kind of trauma. Okay? All right. So first of all, you have a sense of victimization. In order to know this, go to any refugee camp. You don't have to listen to me. Just go there and spend a couple of days and you see all these things. And they feel dehumanized. And then there's a sense of humiliation and shame. And when I wrote that, my friends who are studying the effects of Holocaust in Düsseldorf, Germany, they said to me, we Jewish people don't feel shame. Because shame should be Germans. Yes, you do shame, but for other reasons. You feel shame because of your dehumanized. You don't feel... So it's more hidden than sometimes open. And of course, you feel survival guilt because you survived and others didn't. And then you cannot be assertive. And that's horrible too. That also makes you helpless. Because if you go and say to the guy who's oppressing you, go to hell, he takes his gun and shoots you. So you cannot do it really. So you cannot be assertive. And let's see. You do more, you become very primitive. You become shared, almost you go to psychotic level preoccupations, constant introjections and projections, because what you take from outside is not very good, so you spit it out. So the millions of people get involved in this kind of process. And that, of course, created bad prejudice. There's also good producers, but I'm talking about bad producers. And then you hold on your large group identity as if it is more important than your personal identity. You want to, you can do anything to protect your large group identity. Then the large group psychology takes over of individuals. If you have time, you can talk about suicide bombers. Suicide bombers are not under individual psychology. Of course, their individual psychology exists, but basically they are functioning under large group psychology. And interestingly enough, without knowing, you envy those who oppress you. They have more ability to do this or that, and you don't. So there's identification with the oppressor, and the most important one, you cannot mourn. Why you cannot mourn? Mourn includes a sense of anger toward the lost object. Halina, how dare you die while I'm giving this fantastic lecture and you spoil my fun, so to speak, okay? So I get, God forbid, I get angry at her for creating a problem for me. And that's the kind of normal anger, we don't even know it, we project it to doctors and so on. But if big trauma occurs, the losses are unbelievable. Somebody was telling me 2,000, who was sitting next to me? Yes, 2,000 Uzbeks were killed yesterday. So many, the prestige, your honor, your freedom, how can you mourn? Your anger is so much. So you become like an individual whose loved one dies by suicide or homicide. And you cannot mourn. Very briefly, I'm just telling you why you cannot mourn. So you got nine functions, nine processes includes in you as an individual and shared by millions of people, and you cannot do it. So what are you going to do? You're going to transfer this task to the next generation. Okay? And that's another lecture, how you do it. But we now know from especially Holocaust studies that this happens. Many, many generations are affected. We know from cases. We know that individual cases. So what happens is that a trauma occurs, functions about this trauma are tasks are given to next generation. What we transfer is not the memory of the event. We just don't know what happened. What we transfer are our own injured self and object images and concerning the event. And then we give tasks to the kids or the babies and new generations to resolve these nine unfinished business. And after a while, these tasks are shared by millions of people. All these millions of people are different people. They have different psychology, but they share the same tasks. All the tasks refer to the same event. That event becomes a marker. It's like a notary public. You say, this one only belongs to this large group, and it becomes the most important identity marker for large groups. And trust me, let's say I bring Russians and little Estonians together. And little Estonians representatives dare after a couple of years to say something nasty about Russians. Okay? Right away the second man of Duma starts talking about Tatar invasion. If you are a fly on the wall, you say, what in the hell is going on? But if you know the process, his large group identity is injured and he's going to hold on his chosen trauma to say to you, we had Tatar invasion. And of course, at the same time, it's glorified. They saved the whole world. So Duma guy gives a long lecture to you about how Russians saved the whole world and Tatar invasion occurred to them. And nobody had such horrible event as they did. Okay? Trust me, it happens. It is so predictable now that as soon as you bring large groups, opposite groups together, who wait for chosen traumas to be reactivated in things. Okay. Also, when things happen, Todet described chosen traumas. When things happen, historical events occur in a large group, and whenever a large group, whatever that means, ethnic group, whatever it is, when they say, who are we now? Like former Yugoslavia collapsed, and Serbians said, who are we now? Croats said, who are we now? Bosniaks said, who are we now? When such things happen, they have to hold on all the markers of large group identity in order to exist. Okay? And there is also luck in this business. I don't know how to say it. I mean, when a group is regressed, the leader's personality organization becomes so important. And if you're lucky and you got a good leader, then this regression takes this course. And if you're a bad leader, because they're all narcissistic, because group needs somebody to save them. So there is atmosphere to create a situation so that a narcissistic leader becomes the to save savior. So everybody follows it. It can be Hitler, it can be somebody else. Okay, so there is luck in it. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a story of one chosen trauma, which is a ghost, being reactivated in Serbia. Oh, before I do that, this is also this thing happened. Massive trauma at the end of others gets deposited to next generation. It changed function. It becomes chosen trauma. So massive trauma becomes chosen trauma. Okay, you got that one? And then, years later, hundreds of years later, that chosen trauma gets reactivated with an entitlement ideology. Entitlement ideology is large group mourning. It's in politics it's called irredentism, irredenta Italia, right, my friend, new friend? Meaning, one day I'll get back what belonged to Italians. Serbians have what is called in political science Christo Islamism. Turks have Panturanism. Greeks have Megali Idea. That means large group mourning psychology in its own right deals with those processes and finds out how they started for psychological shared reasons. Okay? When that happens, leader-follower interactions become very hard. A time collapse occurs. That is very important. Feelings, perceptions, fantasies, fears about a past event, this marker, become contaminated with present conflicts. So the present conflicts get magnified. You cannot resolve them. There's no way on earth that you're going to resolve Israeli and Palestinian conflict became so chronic without making a time expansion. If you don't do that, it will time collapse will happen again and they continue doing it. That is another lecture. Okay? So when time collapse occur, this thing's up. I don't know what I wrote there. You can read it. It becomes a very difficult situation. Okay. So, all right. And then they become, the bad decisions are made, and large group identity should become involved, and people do anything, sadistic or masochistic. Everywhere, not only one country or one group. This is a psychological process, the human process. Okay, and then you get entitlement for revenge. Or, if you're powerless, what do? You cannot do revenge. What do? You idealize your victimization. I'm not going to mention a few countries on earth who have idealized victimization. Well, I can mention one. Palestine, if you're going to deal with Arab-Israeli thing, Palestine now has become masochistic, narcissistic. That is to say, it's the flag for all the Arab world, the Muslim world, and the Turks got involved in it. And that is their identity. So they will continue to be masochistic in order to be beaten up, in order to remain a flag. It is an unconscious process. And you need to understand these things in order to resolve conflicts. Okay? So you become number one suffering person. You're like a flag. You don't want to give it up. It becomes an identity. Okay? If you think I'm talking against Palestinians, if you have time, I'll tell you about the problem in Israel. Okay? That's another lecture, but I'll do it. The prejudices get magnified, irrational decisions are made, and then tendency of purification. That means you want to purify yourself, you do shared projections in order to find a new identity. Okay? And this is why we will now give an example of it. And this example is so fascinating, and I spent years on it, and therefore I'm going to choose to tell you what happened in former Yugoslavia. Okay, everybody see, that is Kosovo, okay? That's Kosovo, that is Belgrade. You have been to those areas? Some of us, yes, okay? All right, there was a September 11. You think September 11 happened just in 2001? No, there it is, September 11. There the Muslim flag and Christian flag. Okay? This was the called Battle of Kosovo. And as usual, my ancestors were over here. And Marina's ancestors were over there. where are they? Oh, God, they were over there. And this guy, they had a leader called Prince Lazar. Okay. What happened? Lazar. Oh my God. Oh. There he is. I'm so Prince Lazar. Okay. Unbelievable. But you guys chosen just for that. You know what? I can't believe this, but you guys do. Oh, now we're going to have a wonderful discussion. I'm waiting how it's going to hit me. Okay. But like anything else, unlike George Bush's designation like war or Bin Laden, Bin Laden and Bush became same. You're big blob and big blob, two blob. It wasn't so. Like Turks had all kinds of Christians fighting on their side and so on. Anyhow, the September 11 occurred, but it occurred in 1389. That is more than 600 years ago. Okay, and let me see what I have next. There was no historian who was present during this battle. So how many truths about this battle? Can you guess how many truths? Books written, and there are different definitions, and all of them are true. You see, history is according to how you write, to some extent. There are 25 different versions of it, okay? But certain things are real, like Lazar's son-in-law comes and stabs the Turkish Sultan, and before Turkish Sultan dies, they catch Lazar and cut his throat. So both leaders die, So both leaders die, and the battle ends in 2 days, maybe in 1 day. But many people die. Okay. And what happens next? No. What happens next is very funny. In those days, a peace you made by sex, and so the new sultan, that sultan's son, marries Lazar's daughter. So they make love instead of war. So war ends. This is the Battle of Kosovo. Lasted 1 day and ended with nice sex and peace. Then Serbian guys and Ottoman guys got together for 78 years. They lived peacefully together as allies. And then Mongols came. Mongols came and Serbians and Ottomans together fought against Mongols, and then Mongols gone, and the Turks decided that by that time they were becoming Ottomans. There were about 300 Ottomans, 3,000 people, maybe 30,000 if you're going to be generous, who had an empire of half of the world almost at that time. And they decided, well, we'll get some more, so they come back to start occupying this land. And people from here, Kosovo, they dig the body of Lazar, and he goes and travel up to here and buried here. Okay? And during this time, this becomes a chosen trauma. Not every disaster becomes a chosen trauma. For example, I'll be dead, but I can tell you that Katyn Forest massacre will be a chosen trauma for Polish people because of the history of it, everybody lied, and then, you know, recently Polish president, his wife, and so on, so it became tragedy, and poets get involved in it, and nowadays the internet civilization and so on, it will be a chosen trauma only to Polish people, Katyn Forest occurred. So at that time, only to Serbian people, this Lazar's exile occurred. Okay, you follow me? And 20,000, then Ottomans start conquering everything, and Serbians are under Ottomans, and then poets and whatever you call them at that time, they become, the Battle of Kosovo becomes the thing. There are 20,000 lines of mythology. And in school, they teach it and so on. You go to school, they teach it. And the other thing was that Lazar's image, you see two heads, one cut head and one real head. But Lazar's image goes to the churches and it becomes a model of Jesus. It's very religiously that one day it will come and have great savior. Okay? So, I don't know if it's Lazar or his son-in-law, I'm not sure. And slowly, I mean, these are all still sayings that you can see. And an entitlement ideology develops. Like Italia Redenta, it becomes one day Great Serbia will take place, and it changed function and become the chosen throne. And this was how many centuries ago? Okay? Let's say at that time, 5 centuries ago, slowly become the chosen throne. And Miloš is the son-in-law. Okay? And as time goes on, as things change, French suddenly become independent and so on, nationalism. We are now living in a confused state because national states are not. We have them, but we don't really have them. We have globalization. We are in the middle of a big new civilization, new phase of history. This is why we're so confused, so repressed everywhere, every repression. So at that time, everything was nationalism. And you see now all these martyrs have swords. Okay? And in the Ottoman Empire slowly collapses. Last 100 years, the Ottoman Empire was 5 million Ottoman died, 5 million had to come to Anatolia. It was a horror getting back and regression, and Serbia achieved independence in 1829. And you can see all the history books making reference to Kosovo. You see, it is now a marker of Serbian identity, large group identity. And this is when they liberate Serbia. I understand I have 10 minutes. I'll finish in 10 minutes. Okay, great. I told him to tell me because I talk too much. Okay, and then Austro-Hungarians replace Ottomans. So they become the projection of the oppressor. And Ferdinand, when he was going to Serbia, this is a pregnant wife, they told him, this is the day of the Battle of Kosovo, don't go.
Yeah.
Of course he goes, and supposedly that starts. So it's not only Milosevic, it has been there, okay? And it has been also there during the, before that, like when communism came to former Yugoslavia, if you are brothers and sisters with Montenegrins and Croatians, like in the Soviet Union, everybody brothers and sisters, so ethnicity was written in their internal passport because communism was so good that you can have your little ethnic identity. But they told the Serbians, you cannot have a hero if Croats don't have a hero. So they put pressure not to use the word of Lazar. So Serbs made a wine, red wine, called it Lazar, and every night they introjected it. Okay. And so former Yugoslavia collapsed, and this guy, which is again a leader, you can be lucky or unlucky. Since I have 10 minutes, I cannot tell you, but he had more connection with dead people than live people. His mother committed suicide, his father committed suicide, his uncle committed suicide, his only girlfriend whose wife's mother was killed by his father and so on. Never mind that part. And this okay. So they created a propaganda, and this is time collapse. You can see. Time collapse. It's not 1991. It would be in 1989. My daughter made this for me and made a mistake. It should be 1989. You see, as if the Ottoman Kosovo occurred yesterday. You see, and I know this guy too, the propaganda minister, but I forgot his name right now. Okay, and. So they had this thing. There was a University of Virginia guy who was the Turkish ambassador. His title was an ambassador, but something else. But he was Turkish ambassador. I interviewed everybody to get this story, and he tells you people are people anywhere. They're like us, but when group psychology takes over, they would grab him with the spirit and they'd say to him, why are you guys first coming to invade us again? I mean, Turkey at that time was having so much trouble, they wouldn't even know how to scratch their heads. And so time collapse occurred, okay? So they got Lazar's body, let me see where it is. Oh, well, I don't know where it is, so I'll get the map again. I'm trying to get the map. Now, anyhow, you might remember Belgrade. They put it in a coffin, and it went from Serbian village, Serbian town to Serbian town for 1 year. You see, reversal of, they brought these bones out, and symbolically every night they buried it, and every morning reincarnated. And then a group process occurred, group psychology took over, so that Lazar now is going to come and they will have great Serbia. And this was done not only unconsciously, but also deliberately. Leaders know how to. They manipulated it, and I know those guys. So people got anxious about this, that this may be becoming too much and maybe a purification, bad purification. And so they turned to Germans and they said, Germans like Serbians or blah, blah. The German ambassador should go to Milosevic and talk to Milosevic and stop this. And I interviewed this German ambassador years later, and his methodology was to get this book written maybe in Serbian or German. Used to have dinner once a week with Milosevic and lunch twice a week. So they became very close, and German ambassador was the mouth of the best. But instead of saying to stop this, they did it symbolically. Meaning was that if Milosevic read this book, Sorcerer Apprentice, he will know that if you break the broom, it will double. No, that kind of nationalism is going to double. They made a mess. And of course, then all these people died, and then the Serbians were bombed to stop it. So reactivation of the chosen trauma occurred. They built this monument. Most monuments refer to the time when tragedy occurred, like World War II, let's say 1941 to 1944 or something like this. But in this monument, there's a time collapse. What is written on it is 1389, 1989. And then Milosevic became like Lazar and came from sky to create great Serbia. So this is a story very briefly. When you look at it very closely, it is really fascinating. And Serbian chosen trauma occurred and it led to all kinds of problems. You can see also heads are cut, the people down there. And I cannot get into this. So we know that in order to resolve some of the conflicts, we have to deal with the reactivation of chosen trauma. It occurred almost every time I bring enemies together, they end up reactivating their chosen traumas and time collapse. And so we found some methodologies and technique we developed at that time to go to conflicted areas. And our main aim is to create a time expansion, and that is the angel. We allow the past to come. We accept it as a marker of their identity, but we make it not to be bad. We make it respectfully accept that that is their marker, but use it like an angel so that the opposition party also can hear it, that that belongs to them, and nothing bad about it. Opposition party will have their own chosen traumas, but they don't hear each other. And then we can do time expansion. And we are psychologists. Our team was psychologists, diplomats, historians, etc. You cannot, one branch never knows what to do. You have to get all of them together. And we began doing like psychoanalysis. We use psychoanalytic concepts in conducting meetings. Like, you don't give advice. Who in the heck am I to give advice to Russians or Estonians or Serbians or Croats what to do? But we help them in the long run to have realistic discussion and also not to be lovey-dovey. Most of the Americans who go to these conflicted areas, because they're superpower, they try to resolve conflicts, and because of the regression everywhere, they also regress, the American diplomats, and their way is synthetic country way, because America is a synthetic country. So they want enemies to love each other so that they can make peace. That's the most horrible methodology. We developed the concept of accordion phenomena. We don't want people like this, but we don't want them too close. The accordion run like this, there's a border. You have your identity, I have my identity, I don't have anxiety, I can make plans. I was the last word. I was the inaugural Yitzhak Rabin Fellow in Israel. I was the guest of Israelis for 4 months. I lived in Tel Aviv just before the Second Intifada. And Bill Clinton was, because of Monica and all this thing, he wanted to be sure that he would leave his mark. And he wanted to have Israeli-Palestinian peace. And he came, and since I was at the Rabin Center, everybody there knew what was going on. So I had a very close follow-up of what was happening with Bin Barak and Yasser Arafat. And they did all kinds of fantastic things. And then Bill Clinton did not know about not to make Israelis and Palestinians lovey-dovey. He pushed them, and everything collapsed. So, summary. We are learning about international relations, and suddenly I realized that what we really found out was something not new, everybody knew, but I mean, we focused that you cannot, you have to develop a large group psychology in its own right. And it's just beginning. I'm writing about it, but it's much more needs to be done. And as we learn it, we can have a voice in finding solutions in international relations. And that's how I spent my last 30, 35 years, and give you a little example of what I learned. And thank you again for inviting me and listening to me.
It's my pleasure now to introduce our discussant, who is Ross Lazar, who many of you will know well and perhaps know him a bit better by now. but for the benefit of those who don't know about Ross, Ross was born in New Jersey, the USA, and later moved to Munich in Germany and has been living and working there since 1978. He trained as a child and adolescent psychotherapist at the Tavistock Clinic and the Tavistock Institute, and as a couples and family therapist at the Marlborough Hospital in London. As I say, he now works as a psychotherapist, stroke psychoanalyst, consultant and supervisor in Munich. It's a great pleasure to introduce to you Ross Lazar.
Say I need no introduction, I need a new introduction now. First of all, I would like to thank Steen and the organizing committee for the honor and privilege of being invited to discuss Amit Borkhan's presentation. But I doubt very much that it has to do, I don't know, maybe they didn't pick me because of my name, but it's unlikely that my grandfather, Moshe Lazarovich from Poland, was a relish. Secondly, on a much more serious note, as I was unable to be here for the memorial session on Thursday in honor of Larry Gould, I want to take this opportunity to express my depth of gratitude to him for being, for me, as for so many of us here, such a wonderful and challenging colleague, mentor, teacher, and friend. We will all miss his lively and unique voice, at once so critical and yet so humorous and so full of Menschlichkeit. And I deeply regret his no longer being with us here. Now, thank you, Ramik, for this lucid and impressive and humorous presentation of the historical, psychodynamic, and large group dynamic background analysis of the Serbian-Bosnian conflict in Kosovo and its relevance for similar conflicts, both past and present. Your ideas have raised in my mind, as well as I'm sure in the minds of all of us here, many further associations and questions, some of which I'd like to pursue here now before we open the floor to general discussion. And as I've had the privilege of being able to think about these things in some depth in the last few weeks, as well as discussing them with my colleagues and researching them a bit, I've come up with some further ideas and a bit of clinical material, which I now offer as a stimulus for further thoughts. And finally, I've gathered up a number of questions with which we might open the discussion. So, from individual pathology to mass havoc and destruction. Why Kosovo? This is some case material from the supervision of a therapy session of a 9-year-old boy. In September 1999, my colleague Margaret Klein, also no relation to Melanie, and I had discussed the case of a 9-year-old Sammy during one of our usual supervision sessions in Berlin. Unusual for this session is the fact that at the top of my copy of the session notes, although we couldn't really reconstruct why, I wrote in very big letters, "Why Kosovo?" ? In retrospect, I think Sammy's material speaks dramatically to the problem. Here's a very short excerpt from those notes. After a sadistic and sexually explicit attack on the mother therapist, Sammy cries out, "Now the war begins," and mounts an even more destructive attack on the room, the furniture, and playthings. Finally, he regards the chaos and says, "Now the whole earth is destroyed. You're dead, and you fly endlessly through the universe, but you don't notice it." Of course, it's not our task now to analyze Sammy's individual pathology, his omnipotence, his sadism, or his unconscious erotic and destructive fantasies. And anyway, Sammy at age 9 was already well contained within a therapeutic setting with a competent therapist at his side. But what of the thousands of Sammys, young and old, whose personalities, whose psyches, whose unconscious fantasy life is equally or even more destructive, sadistic, and frustrated as Sammy's was? Are they not the next Prince Lazars? The next Milosevic, the next Hitler, Stalin's, the next mass murderers in Africa, in Southeast Asia, or wherever? Are they not the next fight flight, or indeed simply fight leaders of the next genocides, the next rapists, torturers, and murderers of innocent people? One can argue, of course, that such personalities exist everywhere as individuals, and these individuals, although they may wreak serious harm on a few or even several victims, do not create mass havoc and destroy whole populations, as does the kind of large group violence of which Vomick has spoken. So what's the difference? How do we get from one disturbed person with all his individual psychopathology to the devastation on the larger scale as the events in Kosovo and elsewhere represent? I found some additional answers to this vital and difficult question in Ludwig von Bertalanffy's classic essay entitled Comments on Aggression, first published in the Bulletin of the Menninger Clinic in 1958. Let me quote you some passages which, to my mind, relate directly to Vomick's thesis and arguments, and which attempt to describe the link between individual pathology and mass destructiveness from a systemic point of view. Von Bertalanffy, writing as a biologist, albeit for an audience of psychoanalysts, states unequivocally that, quote, "deep-lying tendencies towards destruction and aggression play an important role in the human psyche." Quoting Karl Menninger, he adds, "a destructive element is present in almost all our activities, from tilling the soil to Michelangelo's violent attacks on marble. The real problem, however, ensues when destructive tendencies and behavior are employed that are not in the service of the preservation of the individual or the species." Unquote. Symbolization makes all the difference. Very much in accord to the views expressed by Vomick, von Bertalanffy sees the most pernicious phenomena of aggression, transcending self-preservation and self-defense, as being based in man's capability of creating symbolic universes in thought, language, and behavior. "Art, science, religion, and political programs," he writes, "are all systems of symbols linked together by suitable rules of the game." And he continues, "the symbolic world of social conventions, of morals, of religion, of art, of science, transcend the individual psychology of the human beings who have created them." Right, we may think, all well and good, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. But how? Through what means does individual pathology get transformed into mass destructiveness at the large group level? Vamik's answers point towards mythologization and ritualization. But what are the psychological prerequisites for a people, a large group, to become identified with the projections and projective identifications being, as it were, offered to it by its flight leadership? Or to put it in Vamik's terms, what leads to the choice to follow the dictum of a particular chosen trauma scenario? What makes them vulnerable, or one might even say suitable, as a large group for the adoption of these myths and rituals, which then lead to destruction both of self and others? Is it the narcissistic wounds of past defeat and its unmourned loss, as in the Kosovo story and in the story of Nazi Germany after Versailles seemed to suggest? Do such collective traumata create the valence, as Bion would call it, to become identified with the propaganda of the fight-flight leadership? How much is due to the herd or horde instinct, the immense pressure that a group can exert on its members to conform to its definitions of right or of wrong, and of what is essential for the group's survival? According to Bertalanffy, all such overriding socially created systems, both positive and negative, have laws of development and an immanent logic of their own that transcend the petty personalities, the human and all too human in their creators. The same, he goes on to say, applies to customs, social institutions, moral conventions, political systems, and so on. And so it is this independent development, an immanent logic of its own, which determines that the grand expressions of aggressiveness always take place within a symbolic framework. So it is this coupling of those ever-present aggressive instincts with mental constructs at a symbolic level that makes us humans such a danger to ourselves and our fellow members of the species. But, he adds, this same symbolic framework can also work in the other direction. It can bind and bond our aggressive tendencies, channeling and directing them to more useful and less destructive ends. And it is this amalgamation of aggression and fantasy expressed in symbolic form which speaks to the large group identity and thus creates the humus in which a chosen trauma can grow. Now I have my own example of a chosen trauma, if I can. A further example of a chosen trauma and its place in the modern world. During a recent trip to Israel, I became aware of a well-known mythical version of yet another chosen trauma, based on a historical event which took place long before the Holocaust and which has become an oft-quoted symbol in modern Jewish Israeli life. It is based on the story of Masada. Masada, as you'll remember, is the fortress hilltop overlooking the Dead Sea, originally built by Herodotus between 40 and 30 BC, and which is most remembered as the place where some 960 Jewish men and women and children are said to have committed suicide rather than be taken prisoner and made into slaves and prostitutes by the Roman legions who were holding them under siege. In modern times, this place and this event have come to serve as a sort of pledge to the future that such a tragedy will never befall the Jewish Israeli people again. The Jewish Virtual Library, that's an internet site, tells us that Masada is today one of the Jewish people's greatest symbols. Now, Israeli soldiers take, or used to take, I haven't been able to find this out exactly, an oath there. Each year, several groups of newly trained Israeli soldiers journey to an isolated rocky plateau on the eastern edge of the Judean desert, overlooking the Dead Sea. As the sun goes down, these groups of Israeli soldiers climb a rugged, winding path on the eastern side of the plateau called the Snake Path. When they reach the top of the plateau, they enter the ruins of Masada. By the light of torches, these young men recite their oaths that make them part of one of the elite fighting forces in the world, the Israeli Defense Forces. These ceremonies always end with the newly minted soldiers speaking the same phrase, "Masada shall not fall again." But Masada shall not fall again is a strange kind of oath to take, given that it is a place known only because 960 Jews are said to have committed suicide there. Strange indeed that it should become a modern symbol of Jewish survival and not defeat. Indeed, the term Masada complex is sometimes applied critically to the advocates of right-wing policies in the Israeli government. A political scientist called Susan Hattis-Roloff has defined this complex as the conviction that it is preferable to fight to the end rather than surrender and acquiesce to the loss of independent statehood. And in the 1920s, a Hebrew writer, a poet, called Isaac Lamdan wrote Masada, a poetic history of the anguished Jewish fight against the world full of enemies. And according to Professor David Ruskius, this text formed a basis for the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. And just to finish, hope against despair. It is clear that the phenomena described here are intractable, even inevitable. But Vamek's raising this particular ghost, both from the far distant and from the recent past here for us today, and his cautious optimism as to its usefulness in better understanding and dealing with, perhaps even combating these large group phenomena at a global level, speaks to us of his enormous experience, his courage and skill, both diplomatic and psychological, in shouldering some of this burden. It is an inspiration to hear him and a stimulus for all of us to try to follow him in attempting to make a difference in how these things develop at the large group, societal, and even global level. And just to end on a contemporary note, let me return to von Bertalanffy for one last quote, where he states, "So this symbolic framework is at least as important as inborn tendencies or instincts. On the one hand, it leads to the most catastrophic manifestations of aggression, such as ideological warfare. On the other, it may be able to check the aggressive tendencies in man. It may do so either by checks imposed on aggression by symbolic structures of conventions, morals, and religion, or by transference to the symbolic level, as when killing the enemy is replaced by a rather mild form of aggression, such as economic competition, or playing chess, or bridge. In other words, long live the World Cup, even if Germany lost to Serbia today. Maybe England will do better tonight.